Well, we're finally to probably the most famous story of Daniel, his experience in the den of lions, and it's found in Daniel chapter 6. Now, before we go to Daniel chapter 6, I want us to just be reminded of the context that brings us up to this, and Daniel's kind of whole journey leading up to this moment. And so, just to ask you, when you think of Daniel, and you tried to envision what he might look like in your head, what do you think of? I think for a lot of us, we think of kind of this event, right? So if you go to the next slide, you know, we might kind of think of Daniel as an older man, wise looking, and that's good. Actually, by the time we get to Daniel in the lion's den, he is an older man. But I just think it's important to recall Daniel chapter 1, kind of the beginning and what Daniel was like. And I think to envision Daniel and what he was like, think more like the next slide, like Henry Cavill, just prime person in every way, because that's what Daniel was. Look at what it says in Daniel chapter 1. When the book begins and Daniel is taken into captivity, it says, "Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans." So, when Daniel was in Israel, he was the cream of the crop. He had nothing but a bright future ahead of him. One of the top people, good-looking, talented. He had everything going for him, and his future seemed set for him. Not only that, he was faithful to the Lord, and so it seemed like everything ought to be lining up in Daniel's favor. And then, boom, Babylon comes in, and they carry him away. And they force him to adopt their practices and all those things. And now he becomes a low man on the totem pole, losing his heritage, his hopes, his dreams, his goals, which would have been so tied not just to a vocation or a profession, but the hope of Israel, the God of Israel, the temple, all of these things. And it's gone with little hope of ever coming back. And as Daniel goes through the books in different chapters and moves through his journey, he experiences highs and lows. He gets rewarded for the things that he does, and he remains faithful to God. And in the midst of his faithfulness, he's elevated in different times, and then he's brought back down low. Not himself personally, but whatever king might have been, that king's out, and another one comes in. So he goes through this cycle of continually trying to be faithful and successful, looking towards Jerusalem, looking towards getting back to Israel, and it never happens. And he constantly goes through this cycle. And when we look back at the beginning and ask, how did Daniel maintain his life through all of this time? What we see is from the very get-go, from the very beginning of Daniel's captivity, he had a resolve. He determined what the trajectory of his life would be, regardless of how his circumstances changed. The second thing we see about Daniel is his resolve. It says in Daniel 1:8, it says, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food." And we looked at that account, and what we see in that example is that it wasn't just a singular event. In some ways it was, but it also charted the trajectory of his life. The resolve that he had there is the resolve that he maintained and he continued throughout the story, despite all of the ups and downs of the different kingdoms. And I just look at that account and I think, what would Daniel consider winning? If you were in that situation, what would you consider as winning? The end game, the goal. Because if the goal for Daniel was to overthrow the Babylonians, if it was only political, he never achieved that objective. And if he only measured winning by whether or not all of those exterior, external things were lining up in the way he thought they should, he would have never been a winner. He would have never been on the winning team. And yet it seems like he operated under a different category of what winning might be. It was a category of resolve. And it was in this category of resolve that he maintained his integrity. And I think what we see in Daniel is a life of integrity, and we recognize that regardless of the shifts of currents, of change, his resolve to not get swept up in what might be other external categories of winning is what forged his life of integrity. And by the time we get to Daniel chapter 6, we see that now this integrity that was developed over years and years of faithfulness was just a consistent pattern of his life, and it was something that he was recognized for. And as a result, he was elevated to this position, because what did the king need? He needed people of integrity. So we see in Daniel 6:3, it says, "Then this Daniel became distinguished above all other high officials and satraps, because an excellent spirit was with him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom." So if you learn about the job of what these satraps are, it says in chapter 6, verse 2, is that these people were in place, it says, so the king may not suffer loss. Satraps and these leaders were put around the kingdom to make sure there was no corruption, to make sure things were lined up, to make sure everything was running efficiently, to maximize the king's reign. And so every satrap would have been, at least as far as they could tell, the highest people of integrity. And of all of the people of integrity that were selected, Daniel rose above all of them. And I think we should recognize an irony that amongst all of them, there still remains some jealousy towards Daniel. And you got to wonder, why would they be jealous of what Daniel is achieving? It's personal ambition, all kinds of other things that we see in our regular, normal, workaday lives as well are just as evident amongst Daniel's peers, even amongst the peers of those who are supposed to be of the highest integrity. And he experiences the same kinds of things that we all experience and that we recognize occurs. Even the people that are placed in positions of leadership that are supposed to be people of impeccable integrity are still frail human beings. And because of this, as a result, Daniel is looked at askew by them. They are concerned that he might be impacting their ability to move forward. And so we see that Daniel experiences accusers. It says in Daniel 6, 4 through 5, it says, "Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground of complaint or any fault because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, 'We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the laws of his God.'" So they really had it out for him, and they finally just said, the only way we're going to find it out, the only way we're going to find anything out with him is to find it against his God. So then they go to the king, and they hatch this scheme about saying, "Oh, king, you're so great. Everyone should worship you. And if they don't over the next 30 days, they need to be thrown in a den of lions," because they knew that way they could get Daniel to be trapped, because they thought, he won't do that. He won't play our game. And don't we feel like that at times in life, whether it's work or whether it's in political systems? It all just seems like a game. And the result of that is that someone can leave that experience or be in the middle of it and just be cynical. And I think it would have been tempting for Daniel to say, you know what, if you're playing this game and it really actually has no bearing on my relationship with God or any of these things, and it's for 30 days, and it's just silly and stupid. You know what? I'll go along with your stupid game because it's just a game. But his resolve and his integrity, it wouldn't let him do that. And I've experienced that kind of a challenge, and I've seen other people experience that challenge in their life as well, where the rat race of different scenarios, different hoops, red tape, it makes you just want to say, this is all a game. Okay, I'll play the game. But Daniel wouldn't do it. He wouldn't bow, he wouldn't change, he wouldn't veer from his consistency. And you might think, how in the world did they let the king fall prey to this? And the simple answer is pride. It is always the downfall of people in leadership. So often at some level, if you can get in through their pride, you'd be amazed at the things you can accomplish. And so they fed on his ego, they fed on Darius's pride, they developed a system, and they were able to put it into place. And then we come to Daniel chapter 6, verse 9, where Daniel has this dilemma. What is he going to do? Because we see in Daniel chapter 9, it worked. It says, therefore, King Darius signed the document and the injunction. So it's set in place, the wheels are in motion, and everything is going out. And Daniel says, I'm going to continue to do what I do. Goes to his house and he prays. The people see it. They say, aha, we got him. And they come back to the king and they say, hey, this guy Daniel, he's not doing what you said we all are supposed to do. He's ignoring you. And so based on this law, here's what needs to happen. And what we see in this passage that follows in Daniel 6:14, it says, then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, know, O king, that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve, continually deliver you. And this is such an interesting account, I think, at this juncture in the story, because here we see that the king recognizes the trap that he's in. And he recognizes that he can't do anything about it. And the result of it is incredible stress and anguish and anxiety on the behalf of the leader. It says he stayed up through the night. He didn't have his normal parties. He didn't eat. He looks for every way possible to get Daniel out of this. He looked for the loopholes. He tried to do anything he could. And finally, they called him on his law. And he just, at that point, was just hoping that something would work out in the midst of it. Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. It says the whole night, he was just a mess. And I think we do need to give some praise to Darius at this point. And here's why. We have experienced over the last few chapters various leaders with Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar and now Darius. And the reason we should give Darius at least a little bit of praise is because he recognized that there was a law outside of himself. The law of the Medes and Persians that they used to kind of set this trap is one that is not supposed to be changed or revoked by anyone, even the king. It is a law above the king. And that's how they trapped him. And it's a lesson, I think, for us to be very weary of any leader who thinks they are a law to themselves or who thinks they are above the law. When you get to that point, look out. What we see in Nebuchadnezzar is a person filled with pride who was humbled. And in his humility, he repented. And then we come to Belshazzar, and what do we see? In Belshazzar, we see a man who operated under his own laws. There was no one above him. And as a result, he was taken out of his position. And now we come to Darius. Not the best leader. We see his flaws. Self under it. And what we see throughout history is when leaders are unwilling to do that, trouble will ensue. Not just for them, but for everyone else. The other thing I think we recognize about this law is it's not just enough to recognize a law that is above yourself, but it also would be beneficial to recognize the truthfulness and the validity and the grounding of where that law comes from and how it might serve us. Because what we see from this law is this law became a burden. This law became a source of anxiety and stress, and he became a slave to it rather than this law operating in a way to give him freedom. And the message of Jesus is one where he says, come to me, all who are weary, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me. And what we see in the law of Christ is a law that actually is definitely outside of and above ourselves, but one that gives us freedom and one that lifts our burden. So by point of application for us, two things to do. One, recognize there is a law above ourselves, and we have to look for it, and we have to submit ourselves to it. But then the second point of the question is, what is the law? Where does it come from? And does it provide us burdens and anxiety, or does it provide us freedom? And Darius was at least halfway there in recognizing there's a law outside of himself. Unfortunately for him, it was a law that only created burden and stress and anxiety. And we know how the story goes. He comes back to the den, opens it up, and says, Daniel, are you in there? And it's a strange question, right? Like, you would think you would know what would happen and wouldn't hear anything. But then he hears Daniel respond back. And when you're setting up for the story, you kind of know how this is going to go, right? Even if this is your first day in a church ever and you heard the story, you're probably guessing that Daniel's going to be delivered out of the den of the lions. Could you imagine if I got up and said, and Daniel was eaten, the end? It just wouldn't seem right. But, you know, those stories are always fun. My wife is listening to a podcast that's following the trajectory of someone who's unjustly imprisoned. He's innocent, and new evidence has arrived, and he's on death row. And the question is he going to get taken off death row? She got to the end, said they really did a good job setting up. You didn't know which way it was going to go, but he was released. And I thought, well, that's no surprise, because you imagine you got to the end of the podcast, and it was like, yeah, it didn't work. Like, so Daniel is released. He's delivered. And what Daniel says in the deliverance, when the king calls down and asks, he says, yes, an angel has been with me. And he has kept me safe. I don't have a single piece of damage. Not a hair of my head has been touched. And you think about Daniel being this old man, experiencing all of those things, choosing to have the resolve, all the things that Daniel saw. And then this event where heaven comes down, sends an angel and protects him in the midst of this situation. And he knows that he's going to be able to go through. I don't know that he knew what would happen, whether or not he would be delivered. He just knew what he was supposed to do. And I look at Daniel, and I look at his resolve, and I look at his integrity. And I look at this story and see Daniel experiencing a life where heaven and earth meet. And I recognize I don't have that kind of resolve. And I don't know how, well, I do know how. I know I wouldn't do as good as Daniel did in this situation. Because when I look early in the story and when I look at the life of Daniel, I see a life that had practices instilled into it. And I think it's those practices that are what kept him and gave him the resolve. And I also think it's the practices of everyday life that he involved that regulated in his life a recognition that this life in this world is supposed to be a world where heaven and earth meet on a regular basis. and that I look at the world with that kind of reality. And so what I want us to do for the remainder of our time is look at the practices that we see in the life of Daniel and then ask, what are things I should be doing in my life that might help integrate more practices in my life in the way Daniel had them, so that I might recognize this is a world where heaven and earth are to meet, and I'm supposed to be aware of it. And it should regulate my life in the midst of such a crazy and flat world. So if we go up to Daniel chapter 6, verse 10, here's what we see about the practices that Daniel had in place. The first thing we see in Daniel 6:10 is Daniel had a place. It says he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber. He had a rhythm of going to the same place, and this is the place he would go, and this is the place that he would pray. And so the first question I have to ask myself is, do I have a place? Do I have a place where I go on a regular basis and say, this is a place in which I am going to pray? And the rhythm and the habit of doing this is going to be a helpful reminder that we live in a world that seems very flat and seems very made of plastic and metal, but it's actually a world where heaven and earth are supposed to meet. I've talked to a lot of people over the years. We talk about prayer and the importance of trying to have a place and the rhythms of prayer and stuff. And you know, I think a lot of times people think my place, my rhythm, and my habit is I pray every day on the way to work. And there's some benefits to that, isn't there? It sets in as a routine. It's regular. It's at the beginning of the day. It helps you kind of set and posture your day. But as I thought about Daniel and as I thought about this more, you know, there's some challenges to that too. Because when you pray while you're driving, there's other things happening, isn't there? There's other things you need to pay attention to. And there's constant moving and misdirection and changes happening in the world all around you that you have to be attuned to. And what if the way habits and practices work, it's instilling into our prayer life a sense of distraction? That if we regulate and habituate prayer as a time where we're moving 60 miles an hour down a road looking at other things, then we go to a place where we say, this is a place I'm just going to sit and be quiet and still, and you're used to praying with all of that stuff happening. Might that impact your prayer when you try to be solitary? And so I thought about Daniel, and I thought about his model, and I thought, should I have a place? And what might my life look like if I habituated a consistent place where I can be still and I can focus and I can just think about the reality of heaven and earth meeting in my life? I think the second thing we see in this example, well, the last thing I want to say too is I think in order to see heaven and earth meet, we want to try to infuse things with sacredness. And so we consider having a place. We're looking to infuse the place with a sense of the sacred. The next thing we see is that he had a posture. Notice what it says in that verse. It says, he looked toward Jerusalem and he got down on his knees. And there's two things I think that are important about that. One, we see this kind of oriented posture. And then we see this embodied physical posture. What might that do on a regular basis? And I thought about that idea about how he looks towards Jerusalem. I thought, well, where would we look? What would we look to? And I thought, well, maybe we would look to the sky. But then I thought, but that might kind of train ourselves to thinking only heavenly. As if we're just kind of waiting for something out there, and we're just looking to go out there, rather than recognizing that what Scripture says is that our promise is a new heaven and a new earth in resurrected bodies. So there needs to be kind of this look too. And I thought, well, one of our practices is we close our eyes. And there's nothing wrong with closing your eyes. I'm not saying that. I'm just thinking. Welcome to my world. This is the things I do. And I thought the problem with closing our eyes, it's not a problem, but again, regular. I think closing our eyes can train us that the spiritual world is all within our mind. And then the danger of that is we can begin to think that meaning, purpose, reality, all our things are just subject to what happens in our subconscious or in our head. Rather than recognizing that heaven and earth are to meet and we're to be there. And then I realized, you know, there's a lot of religious things and they always look somewhere. The Muslims look to Mecca. And I don't know if you know, but old cemeteries that are Christian cemeteries, they always have the headstones facing east with the feet and then the head. And the idea is at the return of Christ, when he descends, they'll be facing him and ready to go. And we've kind of lost that, haven't we? And are there consequences to losing that? So I thought I'd do a fun exercise. I have no idea how this is going to go, but I want everyone to stand. This is going to be fun. All right. I want everyone to close your eyes. No cheating. I've done competitive things with people in this church, and I know you like to cheat. But I don't want cheating happening. All right, everyone, why don't you close your eyes? I want you to face east. Turn and face east. All right, come on, you're thinking too long. 3, 2, 1. Okay, open your eyes. All right, you can go ahead. You can go ahead and have a seat. I guess we have a pretty good consensus. We're not exactly sure collectively where east is, but I did tape it out. To actually face east would be this direction. This is 90 degrees east. So, I want you to think about that for a second. What if when you prayed, wherever you prayed, you thought, where's east? You wouldn't go, well, I just want to know where east is in my heart. Like, I just really feel like east is this way. When you face east, you're acknowledging there's a direction that I am not beholden to. I must find it, and I must locate it, and I must orient myself towards it. It also faces us outward, and it says, I am looking towards something. I am looking towards the return of Christ. That is a reality. This now shapes my understanding of what my day is going to be like because it's not just right now. It is also orienting myself towards a greater reality that I am a part of. And then we think of posture and the idea of getting down and kneeling or doing some other feature with our bodies. And it reminds us when I face east and look towards that resurrection, I'm still going to have a body. It is going to be a resurrected body, but a body nonetheless. I'm not just going to be some spirit floating in a cloud. That gives dignity and a gravity to my physicality. And so what would happen in my life if I started to orient myself in all of these different ways in my prayer life? Might it help build in my life the resolve that Daniel had? And reorient myself on a regular day, understanding my life is to be a life where heaven and earth meet, and I'm supposed to see it. The next thing we see that he did is he had a pattern. He prayed 3 times a day. And we think, man, isn't that hard when you're working 9 to 5 and you got all of these different things and all of these different disruptions? For many of us, there's nothing about our day that is that consistent where we could just have a hard break for any period of time. And yet at the same time, I don't know what it was like for Daniel either. But he found a way. And so what might it look like for me to have the resolve to try to find a way to say, I'm going to find times to do something, because what we want to do is infuse sacredness. So when we point in a direction, we're infusing our world with a sense of sacredness. There is a true east, there is a true north, and we are to orient ourselves in some direction to it. And when we bow or we show some kind of posture, we're infusing sacredness to our bodies. And when we say, here are these times I'm going to pray, we're infusing time with a sense of the sacred. And if there's one thing in our world that does not have a sense of the sacred, that historically always did, it's time. Time functions as a utility. But it was made to regulate the rhythms of our lives and the orientation of our minds towards something else. The next thing we see is that he had a praise. When he prayed, he wasn't just giving his laundry list of petitions. We'll see that next. He gave thanks. And when we think about having a rhythm of prayer that will infuse sacredness, the importance of having a sense of gratitude is so big. And I thought of that passage in James where it says that every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change with shifting shadows. And I thought, how interesting that God's immutability, God's unchangingness, is mentioned in the context of our recognition of his gifts. And so in our praying and our recognizing of all of the good things that God does, it infuses sacredness with his gifts. The word sacrament has as its root the word gift. And so when we recognize the goodness of the things that God gives, we are also recognizing the goodness of God. And so having a habit of regularly incorporating gratitude in our prayers infuses sacredness with the gifts that he gives us, and it helps us understand more of who he is and what he's like. And then the last thing we see is he did have a plea. It says that these men recognized that they came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. And so he does pray about the gravity of his situations, and he makes pleas. And if we enter into this rhythm with regularity and with some of these consistencies, might it shape how we give our pleas and how we might recognize the medical diagnosis, the relational issues, the economic and financial issues of our life. And as we give those pleas to God, we also recognize a sacredness that exists in our circumstances. And that in the midst of these circumstances, as we give these pleas to God, each one is an opportunity for heaven and earth to meet and for us to see God work. So here's the question for us as we close. What might be your place? What might be your posture? When will be your pattern? How might you maintain praise? And then lastly, what currently is your plea? We all might have different ones. And that's probably the first thing that comes to our mind, is our plea. But how might our patterns that we create in our lives help shape and infuse a sense of sacredness as we bring these pleas to the Lord? Will you pray with me? Heavenly Father, I do pray for the pleas that exist within this room. And I pray for each of us that we might take incremental steps in our lives to seek to incorporate a greater sense of the reality of heaven and earth being infused and making sacred our lives, our world, and your mission that you give to each of us. May that shape our resolve and how we live for you. May it forge us with lives of integrity. And may we see your activity in those pleas which we bring before you. In your name we pray. Amen.